Okay, good afternoon. I think we can start this afternoon session with our keynote speaker, Jean-Philippe Bouchot. Jean-Philippe has studied at the École Normale Supérieure in Paris and then was appointed by CNRS. He also worked in the Cavendish Laboratory in Cambridge and then joined the CEA in physics. And he is an expert in physics of condensed matter, glassy system, granular media. And then he became interested in economics and in theoretical finances in the early 80s. His work on finance includes extreme risk models, agent-based simulations, market microstructure, price formation, and he has been very critical about the standard concepts and models used in economics and in the financial industry. And I must say also what is fascinating with Jean-Philippe is that he keeps publishing papers both on physics, on condensed matter physics and spin glasses and so on, and at the same time papers in economy and in finances with a very deep use of elaborate concepts from physics and mathematics. And this is what he does is a very good, I think, example of what can be done with high-power computing, you know, using all the data available in economy or so, and this is maybe a very important outcome of FET as other subjects. So thank you, Jean-Philippe, for being there.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for this nice introduction, and thank you for having me here. On a special day today, because today is the 6th of May, and maybe some of you will know that it's the one-year anniversary of a special event in the stock market, which is called the flash crash. Last year exactly, a little later, 8:30 European time, the American stock market did something a little crazy, went down 9% and back up again in like half an hour, leaving investors befuddled. And I guess that after that and the 2008 crisis, it's clear to everybody that financial markets create risks that are similar in many ways to those of other dangerous industries, chemical, pharmaceutical, nuclear industry, and so on. And so I think thinking about markets as systems, as technologies that need to be controlled, is both relevant and urgently needed, and that's what I'm going to argue today. So, of course, a basic question is why and how do market prices move? And it's a crucial question in many ways. It's a crucial question in theoretical economics and finance. What is the information reflected in prices? To what extent can you trust this information? Is the value of a company as quoted by the market useful? It's obviously interesting for investment strategies. Is there any way to predict the price change in the next day, next month? And it's a crucial question for risk control and regulation. Maybe if we understand the why and how prices move, we would be able to devise efficient risk models and useful regulation to avoid events like the 6th of May last year. Well, maybe. So economics is supposed to be a way of modeling human behavior. And the standard lore of theoretical economics about prices in financial markets is called the efficient market theory. It starts by the assumption that agents are rational, you and me, take rational decisions, are perfectly informed, and that markets are somehow in equilibrium, that supply and demand equilibrate. And within that context, you end up with the idea that prices faithfully reflect the fundamental value of companies, and only move because of some exogenous and predictable piece of news that arises. So a typical example would be, I don't know, the earthquake in Japan and the impact, the true impact on the underlying economy. So if you want, in that, from that point of view, markets are Platonian in the way that they merely reveal the fundamental values without influencing the fundamental value. The problem is that this might be a mere tautology. For a start, if we had a way to check that market prices are equal to fundamental values, we would not need markets to start with. But actually, we need markets to price companies. So is there a way out of this circular argument? In any case, from an engineering point of view or a physics point of view, if we do accept that markets are unbiased devices that measure these fundamental values, how precise are these markets in terms of thermometers, if you want? Is the error a few basis points? Basis points in finance is a percent of a percent, and it, in which case it would be a very good device, or 50%? And Black, who was a very insightful theoretical economist, had a very critical view about this theory, which I share with him. And his definition of efficient markets that, well, if prices are right within a factor of two, we'll call a market efficient. So you see that there's a lot of leeway between a percent of a percent and a factor of two. But coming back to the idea that prices reflect fundamental values, in the extreme case of price moves, that is crashes, it has to be exogenous. Market price cannot jump if there's not a good reason for it to crash, and it cannot be due to market's dynamics itself. And I would like to add, oh really. So after the 2008 crisis, quite a lot of pundits started questioning the whole edifice. So Alan Greenspan, just as the crisis was unfolding, said, "Those of us who have relied on the self-interest of lending institutions, myself included, are in a state of shocked disbelief. Yes, I found a flaw in the theory. I don't know how significant or permanent it is, but I've been very distressed by the fact." A little scary. "The whole intellectual edifice collapsed," he added. Paul Krugman wrote a paper on how did economists get it so wrong, but I prefer quoting Willem Buter in a paper called "The Unfortunate Uselessness of Most State-of-the-Art Academic Monetary Economics" in March 2009, said research tended to be motivated by internal logic and aesthetic puzzles of established research programs rather than by a powerful desire to understand how the economy works, let alone how the economy works during times of stress and financial instability. And indeed, if you look at the standard models that are used by central banks, for example, to adjust interest rates and so on, these models are certainly flawed in many ways. In particular, they have a hard time coping with crisis, and actually they don't include the financial sector in the modeling. So, of course, there are also defenders of the old paradigm, and so David Altig from the Atlanta Fed said, "I'm less convinced that we require a major paradigm shift. Despite suggestions to the contrary, I've yet to see the evidence that progress requires moving beyond the intellectual boundaries in which most economists already live." And Ben Bernanke, I guess, very relevant, and I think he said things which are very interesting in Princeton last September. He said he started also defending the intellectual boundaries, saying, "I think that calls for a radical reworking of the field go too far. The financial crisis did not discredit the usefulness of economic research and analysis by any means." But then later on, he says, "The crisis should motivate economists to think further about their modeling of human behavior," which I told you is in the end the aim of economic theory. "Most economic researchers continue to work within the classical paradigm that assumes rational, self-interested behavior and the maximization of expected utility." And later on, he says something that's going to be very relevant to this present talk. "Another issue brought to the fore by the crisis is the need to better understand the determinants of liquidity in financial markets. The notion that financial assets can always be sold at prices close to their fundamental values is built into most economic analysis." So I guess that in his talk, he addressed many questions that are relevant. I think that most of you in the room will agree that we humans may not be as rational as assumed by the theory. We do make errors. We have regrets. There's a lot of cognitive and sensorial biases that lead us astray. We have either imperfect or superabundant information. We're often in an urgency to make decisions and so on. But intrinsically, problems can be so complex that we have to make suboptimal decisions based on heuristic suboptimal rules. For example, we know that we are deeply influenced by the behavior of others. We think that they might have more information than we do. And that we are deeply influenced also by past patterns. We always think that what happened in the past might repeat and take bets on that. And then there's an issue which, as Bernanke said, came to the fore because of the crisis, is this question of liquidity of markets. What I'm going to argue is that actually in financial markets, even silly trades, even random trades, do impact prices. They move prices, they move markets. And if people see, because of a silly trade, the price going up, he's going to maybe just start imitating this first move. And this is very bad because it might lead to unstable feedback loops. So in order to give you my conclusion right away, my personal conviction based on you know, 20 years of observation of financial markets and trying to model them is also in view of very strong analogies with the physics of so-called complex systems that I'm going to review, I think that the dynamics of prices is primarily due to the endogenous market mechanisms and that they are nonlinear positive feedback loops and multiple equilibria that are some of the mechanisms that lead to the turbulence and crisis that we see in markets. So for me, financial markets are intrinsically unstable. And furthermore, far from being rational and informed, a lot of investors trade on very thin information, and by doing so, impact prices that move them away from fundamental prices with very little anchor to revert them back to their correct, quote-unquote, value. So fundamentally, I think that black is right. Prices are efficient to within a factor of 2. You can say that an asset is worth 100 and not 10 nor 1,000, but it's very difficult to be much more precise than that. Okay, so what happened in the last 20 years, and maybe one of the piece of information that's relevant to the present conference, is that now financial markets offer terabytes of information weekly. We actually, as a company, CFM, store a terabyte of information weekly. And this huge amount of information allows us to take an empirical view to the modeling of financial market and try to investigate this question of why and how prices move. And I think that although financial markets are a subpart of the economy, first of all, it can be very important in its consequence, as the 2008 crisis showed, but also it's an ideal testbed lab for some of the fundamental questions in economics. For example, are the news really the main determinant of volatility? Volatility is the name given in finance to the propensity of an asset to move, so it's the agitation of the markets, if you want. It's the measure of agitation. So this raises the point of whether financial markets are driven mostly by exogenous news or by its own endogenous dynamics. The second question, which is interesting, is are prices really such that supply equals demand? Are markets in equilibrium? And finally, I would like to address the question of how trades impact prices. So the first question is, coming back to what I told you about the efficient market theory, crucial, is are prices mainly driven by news? And in a way to answer that question, we have synchronized 1 minute price changes on hundreds of different US stocks over 2 years. So that's a lot of minutes times stocks times days, if you want. Synchronized this story, this motion of prices with the news feed. So news feed provided by Dow Jones or Reuters or the big news agencies. And the question is, when you see a big price jump, is that related to some news that carried the name of the given company or not? And what we see is that indeed some news make prices jump a lot, but even a cursory look at data convinces you that it can't be the whole story, because actually prices jump all the time and there are relatively few news per name. So if you go deeper in the analysis, you realize that on stocks, only 5% of big jumps, so here there's a convention that we adopted, which is that we call a jump a 4-sigma event. That's already you know, something that shouldn't happen in a Gaussian world, for example, but there's a lot of those. And if you count them and try to track whether there was a news surrounding the jump, you find that only very few of them, 5%, can be attributed to something that seems to be an explanation. But most of these jumps appear, at least from this point of view, to come from nowhere, i.e. be driven by the market's dynamics itself. So actually, our study is a repeat of similar conclusions that have been drawn on daily data, so much less data, by different authors, where again, these authors were claiming that the biggest days in the US market history had little to do with heavy news. But I find more interesting to try to convince you that there are two types of objects here by separating the pool of jumps into two categories, the jumps that occur without news or without us being able to identify a news, and the jumps that appear with an identified news. And if you make statistics on these two pools, you realize that they are very different objects. First of all, the jump size distribution is very distinctly different in the two cases, but what I find more interesting to show is what people call in the field of earthquake aftershocks. When the market jumps, it remains agitated for a while, and you can actually monitor how the activity of markets decays with time after a jump. And this is what you can call volatility relaxation, how the agitation of markets reverts back to normal after a big jump. So in these graphs, you see what happens after a jump with news, driven by some piece of information that really seemed to be there. And in the right graph, you see a jump for which we haven't been able to identify any news. And surprisingly, I think in a way that's very convincing, the relaxation is not the same after the two types of events. Relaxation decays as one over time since the jump after a news-driven event, and one over square root of time since the jump after a jump that doesn't seem to be explainable otherwise. So here I've shown the two colors refer to two definitions of jumps. One is a 4-sigma, that's the black line, and the red dots are for 8-sigma jumps. And the conclusion doesn't depend, that's to show that the conclusion doesn't depend on how we define a jump precisely. So this is very nice because it shows that it's not because we haven't been able to identify the piece of news, it really seems to be two different types of events. So that's the first argument. But if you look at other features of stock price dynamics, you realize that there's absolutely no way to picture the dynamics of prices is a succession of transitions between equilibrium values. Prices move all the time with the same propensity to move from seconds to years. And if you look at the distribution of price changes, you see that it's heavily non-Gaussian. So let me show you one example here. That's a semi-log representation of the distribution of changes as a function of the price difference between one day and the next. And here in this representation, the Gaussian distribution, which is the most common model in finance, should appear as an inverted parabola. And what you see here are these famous tails that people talk about, fat tails, that tell you that there are much more extreme events that you should expect in a Gaussian world. But what's absolutely fascinating about these results is that whatever the traded asset, provided it's speculatively traded, seem to have the same shape for this distribution. So the relative frequency of big moves seems to be only dependent on the fact that this asset is traded and not on what it is. So in this case, I don't even want to define what it is, but it's a, quite a complex object, this thing. It's called the implied volatility on option market, but it could be a currency, it could be a stock, it could be on any market in the world, and it would look like this. The other thing that's striking, at least to a physicist, is that other features look very much like endogenous noise in complex systems. For example, if you look at the absolute value of the price change day after day, and this is the 20th century of the Dow Jones in the US, so each segment here is a given day, and what you see is a representation of the volatility as a function of time. And so what you see is that in the 30s, the volatility was extremely high and remained high for 10 years, whereas in the 60s, the volatility was relatively small. And then there's a very complex dynamics of this object, which is a propensity to move. And if you zoom on, for example, the 90s, or if you zoom on year 95, if you zoom on a particular month, on a particular day, it's the same pattern. The market seems to evolve through intermittent activity, sometimes high, sometimes low. And this looks very much like examples that physicists are used to. For example, that's a representation of the energy dissipation in a turbulent flow, where again there's this strongly intermittent phenomenon. Or this is the Barkhausen noise in a magnet, where either nothing moves or there's a big shock. And what is remarkable in these examples drawn from physics is that the external driving is slow, regular, and featureless, whereas the response of the system to this featureless driving is an intermittent and strongly nonlinear dynamics, which comes from the system itself and not from the drive. So, to a large extent, all these informations that I gave you, the fact that there is this funny distribution of price changes, this intermittent dynamics, are universal. That is, if you look at markets, even wheat prices in France in 18th century look like what I've shown to you a minute ago. So in time, in space, you can look at whatever assets you want, you always find the same kind of activity. So it's very intriguing that although details evolve, of course, wheat prices in France 19th century or 18th century is not exactly equivalent to stock markets in the 21st century, but still these gross features remain. So these observations strongly suggest that endogenous dynamics is the solution of what people call the excess volatility puzzle in the economics literature, which is that in any case, markets seem to be moving much more from one day to the next than what this efficient market story should predict. That is, the fundamental value of assets should vary much less than what is observed in financial markets. But if the whole dynamics is dominated by nonlinear feedback effects, it's maybe not surprising that the volatility is higher than it should be. So the second point I wanted to address, thanks to these high-frequency data that we have now investigate the guts of financial markets, is are markets in equilibrium. And if you look at the data provided by exchanges, you can now identify each trade and decide whether this trade was initiated by an impatient buyer or an impatient seller. So I should be a little more careful in this definition, because obviously each trade is the encounter between a buyer and a seller. But there's a sense in which you can define a buy trade and a sell trade. And if the efficient market story was right, you would expect that people trade on random information that arises. And so the string of signs, so say a buy trade is a plus sign and a sell trade is a minus sign, the string of signs should be completely random, or to a large extent random. But the surprise that came up 5 years ago when people, including ourselves, started looking at this data is that the autocorrelation of the sign of trades is extremely long range in time. It decays over several days or even weeks. And what it means in concrete terms is that if I observe a buy trade now, at this particular minute, then there's a 52% chance of success of getting the sign of a trade 2 days from now, when something like 100,000 trades will have occurred. I still have some predictability of whether there will be more buyers than sellers 2 days from now. But you have to imagine that trading on financial markets now is extremely hectic. It's very active. They are on the order of 10,000 to 100,000 trades per day. So being able to predict what happens 2 days from now means that there is really this effect of long-range correlation. So it's a little paradoxical, because if you can say today that there will be more buyers and sellers today, 2 days from now, it seems that you're able to predict that the price is going to move 2 days from now, because to move up 2 days from now is because orders impact markets. And I'm going to go back on that. So there's a very nice paradox, which I leave to your thinking at this stage, because I won't have time to go in too much details about its resolution. But there's a very strange effect here, that the sign of the order flow is very predictable, and that the orders impact the prices, but there's very little predictability in the sign of price changes. So the two things seem to be self-contradictory, but that's what is interesting here. Anyway, coming back to my question of whether markets are in equilibrium, this is important. So first of all, why is it that there are these long-range correlated trades in the markets? Well, actually, when people speak about liquid markets, think about, you know, IBM or Apple or these heavily traded stocks, people call them liquid, meaning that it's supposed to mean that if you want to buy if you want to sell some shares of Apple, you're supposed to be able to do it immediately. But actually, if you look at the liquidity that's present in the markets, that is, how much would you be able to buy right away if you wanted to buy some shares of IBM? Well, you realize that there's actually an extremely tiny fraction of the market capitalization of stocks that's present in the market for you to buy or to sell at any instant. The order of magnitude is 10 to the minus 5 or 10 to the minus 6. So if you want to buy a percent of a company, which is 10 to the minus 2, it's just not there in the market for you to grab. So you have to fraction your trades in small pieces and come back to markets every day for several days, weeks, or even months. When you talk to big investors, they speak about building up their positions over several months. And so you have to fragment your trades and consistently trade in the same direction for a long time. And obviously, this is what creates the long-range correlation in the sign of trades, because you're detecting actors that are consistent in their sign for several days or weeks. But what it means also is that if these actors have decided to buy or to sell based on some fundamental analysis of the price of the company, they cannot express their information right away. They have to cut it in small pieces and act as if they were small, although they are ready to buy large quantities. So it means that information, if there is any, can only be slowly incorporated in prices because the liquidity is so small. So a good picture of markets is that actually there are two icebergs, one a big iceberg of buyers and one big iceberg of sellers, but they cannot express one another right away. They're like hide and seek games between these big buyers and big sellers that cannot divulge their hands, because otherwise it would give information to the other side. But they have this kind of dance around a market where liquidity is very small, and this creates all sorts of problems, in particular related to the idea that markets are in equilibrium and efficient. Information cannot express itself instantaneously in markets. And the last point I want to address before moving to more general considerations is impact. So again, using high-frequency data, one can measure the impact of each trade accurately. So when you go to markets and buy, on average, the price is going to move up. Of course, on a single event, prices can do anything it wants. It can go up, it can go down. On a single trade basis, you wouldn't see anything. But if you average over many trades, then you start seeing something that comes out of the noise, which is what I call impact here, which is that condition to the fact that the trade is a buy, the price is going to move up by quantity I plus. And conditioned to the fact that the trade was a sell, the price is going to go down a little bit by a quantity that I've called I minus. And using high-frequency data, you can measure these quantities accurately and realize that they are both positive, that is, there is impact in the markets, and they're very similar to one another. There's no asymmetry between buy impact and sell impact. But what it also means is that trading, even randomly, if you throw a dice and you can actually do the experiment, and we've done that experiment, if you throw a dice and trade randomly, even with relatively small volumes compared to the market capitalization of a stock, for example, you are going to affect markets. Even in usual market conditions, we're not speaking here about special conditions where the market is in crisis, trading strongly influences prices and leads to measurable effects. So in order of magnitude, if you trade 1% of the daily volume, you, on average, move the prices by 5% of its typical fluctuations. So this is huge. And this is really bad because it means that, as I was mentioning at the beginning, this can create feedback loops. If I impact prices for no reason, but then other people jump in and follow what I do, then very clearly you can get bubbles and crashes. So from all this information that we gather at the high frequency end of markets, you get a picture of markets which is pretty interesting. On the one hand, there are people who are called liquidity takers, who believe that they have some information and they have to trade on markets, but as I told you, there's not enough liquidity for them to do so immediately, so they have to trade incrementally. And in principle, by trading incrementally, they should push the price in the same direction again and again and create trends. But then there's a counterbalancing force, which are what is called the liquidity providers. They are people who give liquidity to markets. And this fact of providing liquidity to markets creates a buffer against which prices rebound, if you want. And this stabilizes markets in general. But the problem is that these liquidity providers, they're like birds on a wire. As soon as the risk seems to increase a little bit, they are going to leave the market, open the spreads, and not play the role of stabilizing the markets. So markets, I think a good image is the tug of war. There are two sides, the liquidity takers, which are destabilizing, and the liquidity providers, which are stabilizing. And in general, it works quite well. Markets are, in general, stable. But from time to time, one side leads, and this is what happened in the 6th of May. The liquidity providers suddenly left the market and left a big hole there for the market to crash like it did a year ago. So what happens in financial market is a very subtle equilibrium that is fragile to perturbation. So liquidity and fragility of markets is not ensured, it is something that has to be engineered. So I gave you one example of a feedback loop just a minute ago, but there are a lot of feedback loops in financial markets that can and do lead to crisis. So I just quoted this volatility liquidity feedback loop, that is, as soon as the risk increases, those who provide liquidity leave the market, and this is bad. But interestingly, there's a lot of other feedback loops that are present. One which I like a lot is what I've called model-induced feedback loops. The fact that people use models can be destabilizing, and I'm going to try to explain that to you in a second. There are also regulation-induced feedback loops. Strangely enough, sometimes the regulator thinks of something, and the very fact that people try to follow regulation is destabilizing. And then two feedback loops that are pretty obvious to everybody, but one of which I'm going to expand on, is pattern following, the fact that if you see trends, you want to join the trend, and this has a bubble effect. So it's the idea that you learn history because it might repeat. And then there's the story of crowd following, that you follow what others are doing, and panic feeds panic, and this creates crashes. So let me explain to you in a nutshell what happened in 1987. So for those of you who don't remember, in October 1987, the market crashed by 20%, 22% in a single day. And one of the reasons of this violent crash was the use of a model, which is called the Black-Scholes models for options. And essentially, the Black-Scholes model tells you how you should trade in order to protect your portfolio. if you want to be sure that the value of your portfolio doesn't go below some pre-assigned threshold, you should do something. And Black & Scholes tells you in details what you should do, but unfortunately what it tells you is something pretty trivial if you think about it. It tells you that you should sell when the market goes down. But of course, there's a very sophisticated formula how to do so. And a company in 1987 was trading on behalf of people using exactly that formula. And what happened is that this company, LOR, was trading $80 billion based on that Black-Scholes formula, whereas the daily market liquidity at the time was $5 billion. So nowadays, the market liquidity is more like $50 billion a day, so that you have orders of magnitude. But what you see is that $80 billion is huge compared to $5 billion. And as soon as a fraction of this massive of money is going to be shifted around, it's going to impact markets and potentially disturb it tremendously. So what happened in 1987 is that the initial drop was not due to a model, but the use of this model that was coded in people's computers amplified the drop tremendously. So what is ironic here is that the Black-Scholes theory is a theory based on the assumption that there's no crash. So it's a theory based on the assumption of a Gaussian world, of a world where all the distributions are well-behaved, there's no extremes. And the irony is that by neglecting the crash probability, Black & Scholes actually contributes in creating one. And I don't want to go into what happened in 2008, but in a sense, it's history repeating, that models by neglecting global systemic risk created one. How much time do I still have? 5 minutes. Okay, so the second important feedback loop, as I told you, is collective decisions, the fact that people tend to imitate one another. And the point here, and I think that's one of the directions where modeling is going, and it's a very interesting direction, is the fact that collective behavior is often irreducible to individual dynamics. So you cannot reduce a whole population of heterogeneous people to just a single representative agent, as is called in the economics literature. So there is a lot of empirical evidence now that people do not make decisions in isolations, but rely on the choice of others to make their mind. And very often this is useful. If you want, for example, to launch a vaccination campaign in Africa, it's word of mouth and imitation is going to be extremely important. But of course, this imitation also creates sometimes strong distortions and amplification phenomena that can be detrimental. And one example is bubbles and crashes. So here I give a nice little cartoon of what's going on in the example of starlings flying in the sky of Rome. Each individual bird flies pretty lousily, but you see the incredible patterns that collectively they're able to provide. So one can try to model these collective decisions, and let me explain to you the gist of the model by taking the example of clapping at the end of concerts, in big concert halls, which is something that we studied empirically by actually digging out data from people who record these concerts and don't manipulate the recordings afterwards, because as you can imagine, the end of clapping is of no interest to anybody except crazy physicists. But anyway, what happens in big concert halls? Well, if you have the same experience as I have, in some cases, clapping decays very smoothly. Everybody claps and stop clapping when he's fed up clapping. Those who've enjoyed the performance clap longer, and those who haven't stop earlier. But in some cases, there's a very strange phenomenon that occurs, which is that clapping seems to end abruptly. So what's going on here? Well, there's a competition between heterogeneity of people. Some of them want to do something, and others want to do it less. But there's also sometimes a very strong imitation between people. So if everybody is scared of being left clapping on its own, then people will pay a lot of attention to the overall noise made by others. And if this imitation propensity is too strong compared to individual heterogeneity, then you expect something strange to happen, which is that there will be a complete distortion of what people would like to do in isolation, and instead a very strong discontinuity can occur. And that's what can happen in concert halls, but it can also happen in other contexts. So we studied, for example, birth rates in Europe, the way the birth rates collapsed, or the way cell phones invaded markets. In these cases, you can try to understand what's going on by a competition between imitation and heterogeneity. So this is, of course, the same in financial markets. Pessimism, trust, all these things are very sensitive to collective effects, and they can disappear overnight. So what we saw in 2008 was the fact that clearly optimism and euphoria was self-fulfilling. People were confident because other people were confident, but then at one point this becomes unsustainable and any minor perturbation leads to catastrophe. So we need here a change of paradigm. The main problem is that current theories are based on the idea that micro and macro behavior coincide. And so crisis, as I've said very early on in my talk, can only be triggered by a big shock. While in reality, small shocks can trigger large systemic effects. And the case of 2008 is interesting because in the end, the subprime market was a small fraction of the credit market, but yet it triggered a global crisis. So what is needed, I think, both in finance and in some problems in more global economics, is what I've called second generation models. That is, models that realize that markets are complex systems that are made of heterogeneous and interacting elements, and that these systems, these complex systems on their own, without any external perturbation, can lead to a rich endogenous dynamics with intrinsic discontinuities and intermittencies. Feedback loops and instabilities are numerous and are probably at the origin of excess volatility in market turbulence. So there's a very important point is, okay, is all this useful to engineer endogenous stability rules through appropriate market regulation? Can we understand enough of what happened the last 6th of May 2010 in order to avoid such predicaments? Second generation models should include the above features, and in particular the collective effects that I've very briefly alluded to. And I guess some of you have followed yesterday's discussion on agent-based models. There's a very nice paper by Don Farmer and Duncan Foley in Nature, August 2009. And the aim is to try to build more realistic agent-based models of the economy with millions of agents. But I think that this is a major scientific program. There's a lot of difficulties and things that may and will go wrong in this path. So my hope is that ideas from statistical physics, which is my background, should help to infer macro laws, laws that are valid at the level of societies and big numbers, from micro rules, or as Thomas Schelling has put it in the title of his book, macro behavior from micro motives. And there are several projects, partly some of them funded by the EU, and in the US to replace traditional models in central banks along these lines. And I thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much, Jean-Philippe, for this fascinating talk. Giving us a vision on financial market, but also lots of social behaviors. So are there any questions? Yes.
Is there any impact of new information technologies on behavior of markets? Can we say that agents or participants' behavior are similar now and 20 years ago, or are there now major differences between behavior of markets?
Well, as you know, there's a big fuss about high-frequency trading, which is obviously a direct input of technology, and trading has increased its frequency tremendously to the extent that humans are not able to follow anymore for most of the trading. But I think this is the same as in many other, you know, industries where there are things that humans are less good at doing than computers. And if you think about it, the frequencies included in high-frequency trading are not spectacular. There may be a millisecond. There are many industries where much higher frequencies are routinely handled. So, so yes, there are things that have changed tremendously in the last 20 years, but what is surprising is that in the end, barring specific things, events like the 6th of May last year that may be related to this new technology, and I consider it to be a bug that needs to be corrected and probably will be corrected. But what I find most amazing about markets is, again, what I've quoted in my talk, the fact that to a first approximation, the wheat market in the 18th century France, where prices were quoted every week on in small regional towns, and prices of the American stock exchanges right now are extremely similar, which means that in a sense, the computers, they are coded by people, and the same behavioral biases that people have are included in computers, which I think makes sense.
I have a question here, on the left-hand side from the podium. Mm-hmm. Yes. You were saying that physics might be a good place to study analogs of this market problem. I wonder whether biology wouldn't be a better example, because cell biology, for instance, is full of positive and negative feedback loops, mm-hmm. and has to be stable and sometimes unstable to make decisions. And also there is the advantage of 4 billion years of evolution, which has led to maybe stable systems that are still responsive. Have you looked at that?
Yes, I totally agree with you. I don't think that physics is the only relevant background to address these problems. I think that actually this is a perfect example where a lot of people with different backgrounds should interact. And maybe you know some papers by Robert May and other people who advocate the use of models from biology. So I 100% agree. I think that statistical physics is good at one thing, which is the step of going from the micro to the macro. But there are many other concepts that come from other fields that are useful. I don't want to have a jaundiced view on that.
Thank you.
You gave a quote from Krugman earlier in the talk and some quotes from Bernanke. Do you actually feel that there will be a fundamental change in the modeling approaches by central banks? Do you think that's on the cards this time, or because there is an incredible amount of resistance to this kind of approach?
Well, my personal experience on that is, so I've been personally invited by the European Central Bank to discuss these matters, and I feel that there's a strong incentive and you know, motivation to at least explore other ways of thinking. So I wouldn't have been optimistic 10 years ago, although I was trying to say the same things, but I think now there's a real opportunity for a lot of us to contribute and be at least listened to politely at first, which was not the case before.
Any other questions?
In your first couple of frames, transparencies, you had a sentence, the ability to predict the situation tomorrow. Have these findings about the effect of endogenous versus exogenous effects on the market that are very recent. Have they been able to give any progress in this? I know that this problem has puzzled you for the last 20 years. And my question is if the more recent data and the more recent findings have been able to have a breakthrough to answer this question a little bit more convincingly.
So let me be sure I understand your question properly. You mean being able to predict price changes tomorrow?
Yes. This is what you had in your slide. Well,
what I had in my slide was rather the more or less the contrary, was saying that there's a paradox, which is that you can predict the sign of people's trades tomorrow, but you have very hard time predicting how the price will react to that. And this seems contradictory because trades impact prices. So if you follow a simple logic, you would say, if I know that there will be more buyers tomorrow than sellers, the price should go up. But there's this very strange feature that it is at the same time true that I can predict that there will be more buyers tomorrow, and at the same time, I cannot predict whether the price is going to go up or down. So in a first approximation, prices are very hard to predict on timescales larger than in a few seconds. But it doesn't mean that there's no predictability at all. And actually, a lot of companies like ours is trying to extract a little bit of information. And some of this of these predictive models may be based on these ideas to actually trade this this residual predictability. But the slide I was showing was actually saying that to a first approximation, prices are not predictable, but there's a little paradox with the fact that trades are predictable. And of course, I would love to give you the answer to this paradox, but I don't have time to do so.
To some extent, the stock market is a very well-defined system. There is, if you reduce it to endogenous dynamics, then it's essentially traders, and the results of their actions is the stock market prices. So there's undeniable success stories for agent-based models of the stock market. I wonder to what extent you can really extend these models to the economy at large, and why you think that agent-based models of the economy would be as easy, under quotes, mm-hmm. as agent-based models of the stock market.
You're perfectly right, but I hope the EU Commission is convinced that one can do progress on that. Well, you know, when you get... I think it's the usual way science should be made. You try on a small example that you think you can handle pretty well, and then you learn a lot by trying to model these well-defined lab experiments. And then you hope... But there's, of course, no certainty that this experience will prove useful in trying to address larger challenges. But my intuition is that it is going to be very useful to address larger scale problems. But, you know, that's, I think, how we all researchers behave. We start small and, you know, put your foot... a little deeper in the water and hope that you're not going to fall down.
Another question here. You just said again that there is no there's predictability 2 days from now of where things move, but not of the price. But that is, of course, an inherent property of the system, because as soon as there's predictability of the price, the prediction will disappear because people will start to trade. So doesn't that lead to solutions of this problem?
Well, what you say is not entirely true. Actually, one of the problem is that in some cases, it's the other way around. That the fact that there is some predictability entices people to trade in the direction, and this is unstable rather than stable. And one good example is trend following. Trend following is an inherently unstable strategy. So what is interesting in financial markets is that there's a coexistence, a kind of ecology of different strategies, some of which being fundamentally unstable and some of which being fundamentally stable. And, you know, in equilibrium, whatever that means, the two counterbalance each other and you have a stable market. But sometimes one prevails and you get into, you know, bubbles or crashes.
Jean-Philippe, what is the social or economic function of a market in the age of millisecond trading? Is it still an instrument of optimal allocation of resources, or it's just a high-frequency casino?
I don't think it's ever been an efficient allocation of resource tool, despite claims to the contrary. But I think that at least to have markets that are functioning efficiently doesn't mean that markets are efficient in the usual sense, but I think that, you know, liquidity is what makes market useful. If you buy shares rather than houses, and I think that, you know, investing in companies is useful, then what you require is that as soon as you want to get rid of these shares, someone will buy them from you. And so I think that all this fuss about high-frequency trading, I don't believe it's the right focus. I think that actually high-frequency trading has provided more liquidity to markets, again, in spite of, you know, glitches. But overall, the cost of trading has diminished because of high-frequency trading activities. So I think that if you think that it's important to attract investors to provide liquidity and ensure liquidity, at any moment in time, anybody should be able to run in and out of a company, then liquidity is a common good and should be protected and enhanced.
Okay, I think now time is running, and maybe we should stop this very interesting discussion that shows that this kind of subject is extremely rich and promising. And let's thank our speaker again.